But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a sleeper.
Join our league of clean energy at graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Whether you want to
buy, buy, buy
in a bear market or
sell, sell, sell
in a bull market, Jim Cramer can help you become a better investor. Mad Money, weeknights 6 Eastern. Listen to CNBC on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Dr. John Fleming, Louisiana State Treasurer, to talk about recent decisions made by a number of banks relative to the Net Zero Banking Alliance, which is a United Nations-backed coalition of banks. Dr. Fleming, welcome to the show.
Well, hey, Neil. Great to be back with you again.
Happy New Year to you. Recent decisions made by Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo leaving the Net Zero Banking Alliance. What is this emblematic of, and why do we see a number of these big banking operations around the world withdrawing from the alliance?
Yeah, well, as you said, this all began with the UN over in Europe. This was all started. At its peak, there were 140 banks, and their commitment has been to end use of fossil fuel and no carbon emissions by the year 2050. And we all see how impractical that's going to be. We don't have the science and don't expect the science to make that possible, nor is it actually necessary. But also, the consumers out there are pushing back against this. They see the problems we have with windmills, solar technology, electric vehicles, and there's a lot of pushback occurring now, both in government and also in the finance industry. As you know, I push back against ESG, the debanking of companies that are in the oil and gas industry. And I think we're starting to get through to these companies because one by one, they're sort of quietly backing away. Bank of America has made it a point to meet with me next week, and I look forward to discussing these things with them as well.
You know, I don't believe in coincidences. Obviously, President-elect Trump comes into office on January 20th, and one, you know, the cornerstone of his platform has been drill, baby, drill. The industry itself is drilling more than ever before, not because of any assistance by the Biden administration. In fact, to the contrary, he's been more limiting and just recently issued yet another executive order relative to drilling in a number of bodies of water. Is this really all about, trying to align themselves with the present president? I mean, it seems as though it took off when Biden was elected, and now it seems to be waning as President Trump enters the stage.
Well, I really do believe this has a lot to do with it. I think there's a tectonic shift in politics and in policy as a result of the overwhelming victory that President Trump had. He had both a popular win as well as taking all of the swing states. And it really means that he has a mandate now from the people. I mean, you look at the fires that are going on in Los Angeles. This is an example of poor oversight in government work for the people. And they're desperate for someone who has real solutions to our problems, both at the border, but also when it comes to drilling or oil and gas and many other things. And so I think President Trump is the embodiment of how there is a huge deflection in history ongoing right before our very eyes.
You know, it's interesting. I think you've been a supporter of all of the above, you know, energy, but not to the exclusion of one or the other, right? I mean, and being punitive in that approach. And it seems to me that they tried this being punitive, and the public just simply is not buying it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you're right. I am an all of the above guy. If you look in those few rare instances where solar, like in the desert, has something to offer, I'm all for it. I just don't think taxpayers should be subsidizing it. And so wherever a certain type of energy is reliable, and useful and cost-effective. Hydroelectric, nuclear, really, we're going to need all of these technologies, but we can't just simply end the emission of carbon dioxide, nor do we need to. It's just there's really no need for that. That's really a cult sort of viewpoint. And look, our energy needs are going to double just in the next few years as all of these data centers come online. We've got one or two, I think, set up to come into Louisiana, and they're going to have to find grid power someplace.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting how we address those challenges. Your thoughts, I mean, I'm struggling right now with understanding a little bit about what the authority that we give the executive branch of government, meaning the president, as a lame duck. And you are a former member of Congress in issuing some of these executive orders that seem to, at least thus far in court, have to have some permanency and trying to beat that back. I'm wondering whether or not we should restrict lame duck presidents from really issuing a lot of this. And some of this, I think, has been actually retaliatory in nature. It's not in the best interest of the country, and it's not what the country voted for. How do we deal with that?
Well, you know, I was also deputy chief of staff in the White House under Trump during his first term. And that was during the pandemic period. And I processed for the president a number of emergency rules. So it's very useful that a president be able to do that. But the silver lining here is if executive rules are passed in the last 6 months of the presidency, the following president, the succeeding president, can reverse those. He has to go through several steps. But these terrible rules, like you're saying, the offshore drilling ban, both the Atlantic and the Pacific, Trump has already vowed that he's going to stop that. And I think it will be stopped before it even gets started. And so there is a mechanism in place where a president, in essence, can't screw his successor by doing something crazy in the last 6 months of the administration.
But you recall all the special interest groups are going to run to court, right? We do this all the time, and we get bogged down, and it just kind of delays, and it seems as though this delay tactic is becoming more and more prevalent.
Right, and really the hidden truth in all of that is the technique that's worked on these special interests is they plant insiders inside the huge bureaucracy in Washington. So what they can't pass through Congress, what happens is the administration in these bureaucracies, they invite lawsuits, and then they have a settlement of the lawsuit, which means that the outside groups really get their way because of people inside the government that are actually cooperating with them. We need to stop those practices. That's really unfair. It takes away the power of the people in Congress itself. Many of these very, very draconian limitations and regulations that, for instance, Biden has put into place and these settlement agreements have occurred without Congress having any word at all in.
It seems to me, too, this is an opportunity. You know, like I said before, I don't believe in coincidences. These banks are going to go where they can make money. And as they looked upon the Biden administration, they saw that there were going to be more and more restrictions. And obviously, that's not going to be the landscape or the climate under the Trump administration. How much of this is all about making money?
Well, that's really what's concerning, Neil, is why do banks go into ESG and brokerages like BlackRock go into ESG and do things that really is going to lower their rate of return and also increase risk. And what I think is happening now is they're realizing, because if you look at studies, the comparison between ESG funds, environmental, social, and governance funds as a priority rather than return on investment, you find that they're not performing well. And I think that the people are beginning to catch on to this. And so ultimately, these banks and financial institutions know that if they're going to compete in the marketplace, and they're going to get our business, because again, I determine a lot of the bank activity that happens in our state, they are understanding that it's all about return on investment and safety of investment. And I think they're slow to come around, but I do believe they're beginning to come around, as evidenced by what you're talking about in the Net-Zero Alliance.
Yeah, I mean, because what happens is we get a lot of foreign investors that are willing to come in and put their money down to finance this fossil fuel industry, right? In fact, my next guest, we're talking about this with the coal industry. I mean, it's amazing how we were promised by John Kerry and others that, you know, those in Asia and otherwise were going to be more restrictive in the utilization of coal. It's not true. It's not happening.
Absolutely. In fact, I was down at one of the ports below New Orleans a couple of months ago, and we were doing a flyover in a helicopter. And I looked down there and I saw a big barge full of coal. And I asked, where did this come from? They said, Illinois. I said, where is it going? Oh, it's going to foreign countries where they burn coal. We can't do it here. So the point being, what good is it to restrict coal and even oil and gas when other countries are putting it into the air, such as China and India?
Yeah, two of the biggest violators of the Paris Climate Accords. I mean, it's kind of this backward way of thinking that we have here as it relates to our foreign policy, especially on climate. I used to think other areas was bad, and then where we stand in climate right now is just completely mystifies me as to why we think this is working out for this country or the world in general.
Right. Well, as you know, the United States is not part of the Paris Accord, yet through natural gas and fracking, we are actually achieving all the gains and goals through lower carbon emissions that come from that. But on the other hand, those who are in the Paris Accord are actually not performing, and they're actually using the very substances like coal, the dirtiest form. And so, really, the whole thing is a shame.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where this ends up, and obviously how much pushback the incoming administration is going to have on some of their initiatives. As always, we truly appreciate your time, Dr. Fleming, Louisiana State Treasurer, and your insight. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Great. Thanks, Neil. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. When we come back, we'll visit with Diana Furchcott-Roth. She is the Director of Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment at the Heritage Foundation. And we'll talk about this billionaire mining magnate, 76-year-old Lo Tuck Kwong, ignoring all of what everyone was saying about coal. And now we are producing more metric tons of coal and burning more metric tons of coal than we did back in 2013, contrary to everything we were told about the future of coal. He doubled down. And wait till you hear the amount of money that he's making and how much wealth he's created in a very short period of time. We'll be right back. So some experts had concluded that coal consumption peaked in 2013, and it has since surpassed that level 3 years in a row now, and they are now have abandoned all of their projections relative to coal use, and they believe that it will increase through at least 2027, contrary to what climate czar John Kerry had predicted about Beijing, meaning China. With solar and wind investments, China now consumes 30% more coal than the rest of the world combined. And these projections are changing fast, and folks are abandoning almost every prediction that they made on the coal front. And here to talk to us about it is Diana Furchcott-Roth, Director of the Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment at the Herbert and Joyce Morgan Fellow in Energy and Environmental Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Diana, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Neil.
So, Diana, is it true that we just completely missed this target, as people are saying, totally?
Well, I don't think there's any reason that we need to be using less coal and oil. I think that's a fundamental fallacy. Politics is full of surprises. No one knew that Russia was going to invade Ukraine. No one knew that Iranian-backed Hamas was going to invade Israel. But we should have control over our energy. We should not have surprises over our energy. And the reason that China is burning more coal is because that's what China has. It doesn't have oil and natural gas the way we do. And we should be using our oil and natural gas. We should not be shying away from using our coal, which, with scrubbers to go on top of the coal-fired power plants, is clean. We have clean coal now.
So I kind of feel like we're completely bamboozled by this climate czar, John Kerry. I mean, almost every prediction that he has made has turned out to be not true in a very short period of time.
Yeah. Right. And it was on one of his visits to China, by the way, that President Xi said that President Xi was not going to stick to the Paris Agreement that China had previously agreed on, and that China was going to peak emissions on its own timetable, not on a Western timetable. So China, which is the largest consumer of coal in the world, wants to continue to use coal. And they're not going to listen to John Kerry telling them that they shouldn't be using coal.
But Kerry came back and told us that we should be proud of the advances that Beijing had made as it related to their climate policy. It was just talk?
It's just talk, yeah. I mean, that's one thing politicians are really good at, Newell. They're really good at talk. They're really good at spin. And it's true that China has been building more wind and solar. If you think that's something to congratulate China on, the way John Kerry does, you can congratulate China on it. But China's also building about one or two coal-fired power plants a week because China has coal. And it wants to electrify its transportation system because it doesn't have oil and natural gas the way we do. It cannot make gasoline the way we can here in the United States. So they want to electrify everything so that they have these big power plants, they operate the electricity grid, and people drive EVs that are charged up through the electricity grid by using their coal. Do you follow? Is that clear?
Yo, absolutely. I mean, they're going to do what's in their own best interest. They're going to take the path of least resistance and what makes economic sense to them, right? Now, we, on the other hand, for the last 4 years have been salmon swimming upstream as it relates to energy.
Right. We need to do what's in our own best interest. And our own best interest is using the oil and natural gas that God gave us here in the United States and not becoming dependent on China by switching to solar and wind power, which are more expensive, which cause a deterioration in our grid.
So, Diana, I guess you read that Wall Street Journal article, the billionaire mining magnate who bet coal had a future and won big.
Yeah.
And as I read through this article, it was very well written. Well done. John Emon is the author. I don't know him. Maybe you do. Lo Tuck Kwong, the 76-year-old businessman who is behind one of Asia's largest coal mining complexes.
Yes.
He is now on the Forbes 100 richest people. He wasn't even close before. His wealth is estimated to swell to $28 billion from $1 billion in like about 3 to 4 years.
I mean, yes.
It's absolutely incredible. All on the back of coal. And I think he saw exactly what you said, is that these folks are not going where everybody say they're going. They're going right back to coal because it's the cheapest energy available to them, right?
Yes, and also because the demand for electricity is going to continue to rise. People want more electricity. People want to charge their phones. They want to use data centers. People who don't have air conditioning want to have air conditioning. People who don't have heating want to have heating. There's 3 billion people in the world without electricity and running water. And I can assure you that they want electricity and running water and that their health will be immeasurably improved by having electricity and running water.
So So our approach has been, as is pointed out in the article, and I'm just going to read it, the U.S. and other wealthy countries have offered billions of dollars in financing to encourage such developing countries as Indonesia, Vietnam, South Africa to retire their coal plants in favor of green energy. But the skeptical leaders there in the developing world say aid, mostly loans, isn't enough to overhaul their energy grids while saddling them with debt. You know, what's amazing to me is that we tried to engage in a policy that all of these folks that we're trying to convince recognize it's BS. It ain't going to work for
us. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Why would we keep going back to that well? I don't understand.
I even had the head of a German automotive trade association come and see me yesterday and assure me that Africa can manage perfectly well on solar. Well, there's no way that these African countries can power the manufacturing they need to raise their standards of living with solar energy alone. And solar energy needs batteries as backups. It's like having two systems. You have a solar system, you have a battery system. And a solar system might work fine for someone out on a farm who wants to maybe have a hot water heater or something. But it doesn't work for giant manufacturing plants, which is what Africa needs to raise its own standard of living. And it's really racist saying that these developing countries can manage on wind and solar after the West has industrialized using fossil fuels. It's racist.
Well, yeah. I mean, if we want them to stay in the landscape of status quo and not improve their quality of life and everything else, yeah, it's perfectly fine. We'll throw up some solar panels. We'll in fact, give it to them, right?
Yeah. I mean, basically saying you're fine in your village. You don't need to aspire to more.
Which you know, it's interesting how we speak out of both sides of our mouths sometimes, because that's totally contrary to what we believe in this country.
Exactly. Yes.
So where do we go from here? I mean, you know, how much longer do we do folks buy into this boondoggle? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be where do we go from here? I think that these countries are taking their own paths. Whatever we say here, China is building more coal-fired power plants. Other countries are looking to buy more natural gas, putting in nuclear power plants, using whatever resources they have to get ahead economically. These ESG funds are failing. People are dropping out of them because without fossil fuels, these funds do not do as well as other funds. So we might say everything we want about ESG, about the benefits of wind and solar, but if you look at what people are doing in practice, they're not listening to us. They're doing what's in their own self-interest, which is what they should be doing. Because climate change is a future risk that has to be managed. Poverty is with us right now. We need to be dealing with the reality of poverty now and adapting to a potential future risk by, if the world is getting warmer, we need more air conditioners. These headlines saying Baltimore hitting record temperatures, climate change measures needed. No, people in Baltimore need air conditioning.
Yeah, people are dying because of the heat there. Yeah. And then on the eve of leaving inside the Beltway, the Biden administration is handcuffing us with all of these measures, whether it's gas, hot water heaters, and you know the elimination of drilling on so many different waterfronts. I mean, it just keeps going on and on and on. And what's interesting to me is that so many different countries and their governments are in transition. I was just talking to our state treasurer about this right before you came on. We're in transition on so many different fronts. And one of the issues that is driving all of this, and we saw this with Justin Trudeau in Canada, climate policy. Canadians are recognizing they're taxing us to death on this climate policy, green energy thing, and none of us are reaping the benefits of any of this. And they're confused.
That's absolutely right, Newell. And if you look at where people are moving, there's so many people moving to Texas, and Texas has above average temperatures. If you look at the United States as a whole, people want to go to warmer Texas. They want to go to Louisiana. They don't want to go to New England. New England is losing people, even though its temperatures are lower. So where people go doesn't depend on where the temperatures are in that particular state. It depends on the conditions of growth in that particular state.
So from a policy perspective, I know you guys have probably been following what the Biden administration is doing, trying to handcuff the incoming administration. Will the incoming administration be successful in beating back a lot of this stuff?
I believe it will, because a lot of these last-minute regulations can be rolled back with the Congressional Review Act or through other means. So I believe it will. But I think there's a more fundamental problem, which is President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris have been calling the Republicans anti-democratic. It's been a drumbeat. The Washington Post has a headline, "Democracy Dies in Darkness." But here, they have just faced a rejection, a massive rejection of all their policies. They've lost the White House. They've lost the House. They've lost the Senate. And what are they doing? They're doubling down on their agenda. They're saying, we got to future-proof our agenda, even though it's absolutely clear that the American people don't want it. That's anti-democratic, if anything was.
Yeah. Yeah, to future-proof our agenda. We don't really care what the voters say when they go to the polls any longer, right?
Exactly. That's what they're trying to do. That's what they say they're doing. They say they're future-proofing it. But the American people are too smart. They're not buying 70% of new vehicles as EVs. They're not going for these electric water heaters. They want to keep their natural gas stoves. So I think the common sense of the American people is going to prevail. And as George Orwell says, there's some ideas that are so absurd only an intellectual would believe them. And Depending on Wind and Solar is one of those.
I'm glad you reminded me of that one. I totally forgot about it. I mean, it's so true on so many different fronts, right?
Yes.
Well, Diana, thank you so much for joining us. I just, when I read this article, I just felt like I've been completely bamboozled on this front, especially as it relates to coal, and that, you know, coal production and coal utilization is going up. And now all of the folks that said, nah, it's going away, are now changing all of their predictions because it's not. And
we also need to look at their predictions for a just transition to net zero. That's not happening either. We need to look at their predictions for an end to natural gas use. That's not going to happen either. We're going to have more natural gas. We're not going to end fossil fuels. And even if we did, it wouldn't make any difference to the climate. If we ended in Western Europe, in the United States, it only makes a difference of 0.3°C by the year 2100.
And the one thing we know for sure is we do it better, safer, cleaner, more efficiently than anyone else in the world. We're not going to stop them from doing it, but we could be dominant here, and we could protect the world by doing more here domestically, right?
We definitely could, yes. Yes. And we have reduced our carbon emissions. If we care about that, we've reduced it by 1 billion metric tons over the past 15 years, whereas in China, it's gone up by 5 billion metric tons. Moving our energy-intensive manufacturing from Western Europe and the United States to China does not reduce global emissions. And people who care about these global emissions shouldn't pretend that it does.
Yeah, mind-boggling. For sure. Diana Furchtcott-Roth, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great weekend.
It's great to be with you. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Diana Furchtcott-Roth is the director of Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment at the Herbert and Joyce Morgan Fellow in Energy and Environmental Policy at the Heritage. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. I really enjoy talking to Diana Furchtcott-Roth as it relates to climate policy. She's really on her game, and every time I just learn so much every time that I spend a little time with her, so I really appreciate her joining us. Today, it's No Filter Friday. Let's go back to the talk lines. Patrick, you're up. What say you?
Good afternoon. I simply wanted to say that I enjoyed President Biden's speech at the Carter funeral. My days are kind of running together, but yesterday, the day before, it was a very good speech.
Yeah, I didn't get an opportunity to hear it all. Someone called right after he started, and I got distracted, so I didn't get to hear it. So what about the speech did you enjoy?
Considering how all of the top persons were there, you know, right there in center stage in the picture and all, there was a discussion about character, and it's very good for the time. I can't say that I've ever been, supportive necessarily of some views of the current president. But anyway, it was a very good speech. And
you thought a lot of that was a hidden message directed towards Trump, and you liked the fact that he took that approach?
Oh, I would say definitely. It was blatantly obvious. That's many of the people that were there front and center don't necessarily agree on all sorts of things. But it was a good speech.
Yeah, you could tell there was a lot of tension in the room, right?
Yes, I would say so. I liked to have been there.
It looked like the vice president and her husband, there was tension there. I mean, they didn't even look at one another. I mean, it was funny. No one was looking at anybody. I mean, it was kind of like they're all looking straight forward and were afraid to get in the eyes or in the view or the gaze of someone else. It was kind of odd.
Well, I will say 44, I think that's right, when President Obama did shake everyone's hand basically as he entered the stage. So, thank you.
Hey, he looked like he was having a good old time with President-elect Trump. I mean, they're sitting there talking, laughing, and obviously the vice president kept looking over her shoulder, wondering what the hell was going on as they were heckling back then. didn't seem to be very happy about it either. Thank you so much for the call, Patrick. Have a great weekend. I wanted to say I was going to talk about it earlier, but we got sidetracked. But I'll just take a few minutes. Tommy Tucker's interview with Peter Whitford, the CEO of Meridian Rapid Defense. Those are the Archer barriers. You really want to go back to Odyssey.com and listen to that interview. Tommy did a great job, pulled out a lot of the details about what this system actually will do, these Archer barriers, how little maintenance is required. It's all about the execution. It's all about the deployment. And I have to imagine it's going to be interesting to see whether or not we see any of this in the security plan. I suspect it's probably there. It may not be directly mentioned as the Archer barrier, but I have to imagine that it's there, and it's just about whether or not we would deploy. You know, the folks were talking about the weight of these things, how difficult they are, and interestingly, as Tommy was pulling the facts and the details out of Mr. Whitford, he says, like, we have a trailer. We show people how to load it on this trailer. You hook it up to a truck. You pull it to the site, how you unload it. One person can do it with an arm that we provide that actually attaches to the barrier, so you don't have to worry about losing it if you have the barrier and you don't have the arms. Very interesting conversation, right? You have to have the will and desire to implement, deploy the security measures that you've spent good money on. And what's interesting is the manner in which they move these Archer barriers. I think he said they're on the eighth iteration of the apparatus. All of these security equipment companies want their stuff to be looked upon as having ease of deployment. They all look at that. They all desire that. That's why they keep improving upon the manner in which you're able to move a 600 or 700 pound piece of equipment. And Mr. Whitford, the CEO of Meridian Rapid Defense, said, we do this with one person. We've always been able to do it with one person. It's actually easier to do it with one person today than it was ever designed for. Interesting. Go back to the Odyssey app and listen to Tommy's interview of Peter Whitford. I think you'll enjoy it. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. It's free for all Friday for Scoot. We'll check in. I mean, actually, Ian is in for Scoot today, so we'll check in with Ian when we come back. Welcome back, folks. Free for all Friday with Ian Hoke today.
Good afternoon.
Ian, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing, bud?
Doing fine. Happy New Year to you, my
friend.
And
to you as well. We haven't spoken since then. Wow, it's interesting that this song is on right now because it was just in my head this morning. I was reading about the fires and, you know, this entire song is just a list of places in Los Angeles County, Reseda, yep. Ventura Boulevard. It's been in my head all day. There it is.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Have you been watching these fires? I mean, this is like devastating. I mean, my heart goes out to these folks. They're running for their lives.
Yeah.
Every moment of every day.
I have a friend of mine from high school texted me just a couple hours into the New Year's Day terror attack. She lives in Los Angeles, and she said, "Oh my God, are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, I'm okay. Everyone's okay. Thanks for checking in." And then we had no idea that just a few days later, I'd be texting her to ask her the same damn thing. She had to evacuate. Her sister's house burned down. Things are going very poorly for her. In regard to the fires, at 2 o'clock, we'll be speaking to a reporter from KNX News in Los Angeles. Natalie Trevidian was busy covering the fire, just the same way that we cover things here at WWL. And her childhood home burned down while she was at work. We will hear from her about that experience. We'll also talk to Phil Napoli from Duke University about Facebook boosting political content after years of downranking it and also ending central fact-checking. We'll talk about how that's going to change what you see and what you experience on Facebook. It's going to be a great show, Newell.
All righty. Your way with the great lineup, folks. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great weekend.